How are you, Chris?
I'm great, man. Always good to be here.
Thank you. This is a second, third, fourth time, it feels like, because we've re-recorded a few times. So, you know,
it's merging with like times when we actually just talk, you know? Exactly. And so like 3 a.m, it's like, was that a podcast too? Or like,
we've had so many conversations. So I'm glad that we're back here. We have a few things that I wanted to, you know, ask you about, you know, because I deal with it, you know. The thing, we'll just jump right into it, is this idea of the work that we do. It's we are third culture kids trying to get something, you know, inside of us to be right. And I think the work that we do is challenging us to dig deeper into the Vietnamese culture from Vietnam and as a Vietnamese American. And sometimes, you know, the idea of imposter syndrome seeps into the work that I do. And I think you and I have talked about that. And I'd love to really discuss that with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's something I definitely feel, Ken. So happy to talk about it.
Yeah. And the reason why we have that connective tissue is because you are, you know, in the space of teaching Vietnamese language to, I think, Vietnamese Americans or Vietnamese diaspora, third culture kids too.
And non-Vietnamese.
Yeah. And so I think that lingering feeling of imposter syndrome is like, it floats inside of our brain every now and then. And, you know, one would love to hear your thoughts on how you deal with it.
Yeah. It is kind of like the double-edged sword of being bicultural, right? Because the plus side, which I'm starting to embrace more now, is that we can jump between these two worlds. You know, we do have a deep knowledge of like our American upbringing, American culture, and then our Vietnamese upbringing is definitely there. And, you know, sometimes when someone asks me, I respond, I'm Vietnamese, you know, and sometimes I respond, I'm American, you know, I jump between those two worlds. That's kind of the big plus. But then the other side of it is that, you know, maybe, you know, especially with the work that we do, presenting culture and discussing these things, we don't get seen as credible. And that's something that I think I do experience making content. And I don't want to dwell on the negative of it, because it is like 90% positive feedback. Absolutely. But there is this thing that happens, I think, where when I discuss Vietnamese culture, discuss Vietnamese language, I get a sense that maybe some gatekeepers out there, or some traditional folks, or you know, folks just maybe living in Vietnam or have lived in Vietnam longer than me, are like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, and it's like, I don't know what it is. If I sat down with them, I could maybe get the answer, but I start to kind of guess, and I'm like, is it because I'm a Vietnamese face speaking fluent English? And they're like, this guy's not even Vietnamese. He's just, you know, one of those like American Vietnamese kids, which I hear this term sometimes. And like, you know, maybe people in the comments can tell me if this is actually negative, but I've heard people say like, Mekong. I don't know if you ever heard that, Ken.
Yeah, I heard it my entire life growing up. And
okay, there you go.
I still get it. I still get Mekong. And it's not something that I embrace. I don't like that term, because I want to.
It doesn't feel good.
Feel good. Yeah. A derogatory comment, you know?
It reminds me of. I'm sorry, Ken. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I don't know if this is completely the same, but some of my Mexican friends, you know, they told me about this term, like, no sabo kid. It's basically like a Mexican, probably most likely Mexican American that grows up in the U.S. that goes back to Mexico, and it's just like, can't eat this, or can't speak Spanish, or doesn't know this. Like, he's too American. You know, he's a no sabo kid. So like, Mekong, I think, feels like that. You know, he's like this American kid, grew up, you know, in like, you know, urban America or suburban America, and like has this kind of like very superficial idea of what Vietnam is, and it's just like so American that, you know, they don't even basically count as part of Vietnamese culture. And it's like, ouch. You know?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax? Dax?
Sorry, did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Oh, the...
Right. Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.
I get it. You're going through the language side, and I'm going on the political sort of, not political, but yeah, political and history, academic side of the conversation. And my deal is that I'm asking questions, but what I always think about is like, where am I asking the questions from, right? Like when I load the questions up, it's like I have to be very mindful of like all the perspectives and all the books that I'm expected to have read, because I get called out with my close friends. They're like, you know, when you ask that question, you should have read this one book. And, you know, they'll go down this rabbit hole of these academics. And so the imposter syndrome that comes from all of this work is real. But I just want to ask the world to give us some credit for being bridges to do you know what I mean, Vietnamese American kids who are born here who really have no connective tissue that was developed, you know, as a result of their young parents coming to the United States wanting them to assimilate. I feel like, all right, just give us a little grace, because we are doing the bridge building work. Although it comes from a very selfish place for me. I want to learn, and I want to know more about the history. But oftentimes the ignorance of not knowing everything really gets in the way of trying to figure what the next question is.
Yeah, no, I think that building that bridge, I think we kind of take on the, criticism, right? Because we're not the experts. We have the intention to build a bridge. And that's something that a lot of people don't have. I had this conversation the other day with somebody who asked me, like, why do I do this? Why do I make content about Vietnamese culture, Vietnamese language? Sometimes I get into the history too, because I am a history major and I'm a huge history nerd, as you know, Ken. I just thought, I'm not trying to say I'm special, but there's not like a lot of people like us, I would say. This is like, you know, just based off of what I know with my own friend circles, a lot of people have obviously this love of Vietnamese culture and this curiosity, and they love, you know, getting bits of content that I put out, and they're like, oh, I really appreciate this content. But like the people that have really stepped really deep into it, you know, being born in the US or having left when they were like one or two, like you can, you were born in the US.
I was born
on American soil. Yeah. And then just going so deeply into the scholarship, into the language. I went and studied abroad in Vietnam, and then I spent 6 years in Vietnam after that. You know, the both of us reading so many books, talking to experts, and like always feeling like, oh, I need more. You know, like that just made me feel like there's so much more I don't know, and I just gotta keep seeking. And I think that there's not a lot of people doing that. And I mean, I guess I'm just trying to give us some credit too, like, you know, like give us some grace, you know, like us out there building that bridge. It's clumsy, you know, like we're not the experts. The experts aren't always building the bridge either. You know, like they're in their expert cave doing their expert thing. That's great.
They don't need to.
But we're finding them.
Yeah,
they don't need to build a bridge.
They don't need to
build. Yeah, we're like, hey, people need to know about you. And it's like, let's bring you out of that library you're at, or, you know, wherever, you know?
Yeah, their job is not to build bridges. Their job is to do the work of the research, the deep research that they're doing. And I think there's just a place for everybody. I think that we've really we've really gotten into this navel gazing, you know, and I think that it's kind of funny to talk about. But at the end of the day, in all seriousness, I love what I do, and I wouldn't give it up, you know, for anything. So
I hope you don't.
You too. I think that it's fun. It's been fun, and it's just been fun to kind of meet the new people along the way, whether they're professionals inside the culture space or they're just guys like us who are just kind of like clumsily bridge building as we go, you know?
Yep.
So you have made such a huge transition from your Instagram content, where you have made skits, you've gone over language, you've gone over words, and now you are really, you've jumped into the deep end of the pool with, you know, creating a living. And I want to hear about the two projects that, you know, you've been working on so much these last few months.
Yeah. So about a year ago was maybe when the Vietnamese teaching journey started. And I mean, now looking back, these are all projects that I've dreamed about in the past, but I've just like, they were so buried under just life. And coming back here to Vietnam and, you know, deciding to live here long term and then making content and then people seeing that content and following. And then hearing people say, you know what, I'm just following this page because I'm actually picking up some Vietnamese from it. And then just little things like that started sparking a lot of just inspiration for me to do more. And maybe it's the teacher in me, you know, that's just like, oh, wow, I want to, like, you know, I love guiding people, giving people, you know, the satisfaction of learning something. And how meaningful is the language, you know? And I know me and you, we both talk about this a lot, Ken, that the language is such a huge, not just huge, but essential tool, right? For like understanding deeply Vietnamese culture and connecting to the community and the older generation. So then I just basically, with going through the imposter syndrome and fighting it, you know, decided, you know, I'll make a self-paced course to teach Southern dialect Vietnamese. I didn't want to like just teach the language itself, because that's a lot, the grammar and everything, because like me just kind of learning it as a kid, I don't feel super confident. I did study it in Hanoi, but, you know, I'm not a Vietnamese teacher. So then I taught pronunciation, which I felt like I was pretty good at. And I still did tons of research for it. And then I did that, you know, just a self-paced course. And then one thing led to another. Got a lot of community support on my page, which I'm so happy for. I'm so grateful for the community that follows the Chris Tran Travels account. They're just so supportive and so appreciative of, you know, the learning content that I put out. And then next thing you know, a year later, we have a full-on Vietnamese school. It's full-on. It's like, I have to pinch myself. We have right now 5 teachers. We have teaching assistants. I have to tell people, you know, that I don't teach. You know, I present the language. I'm here with a team. I have ideas about what I want to talk about. I double-check with them, local Vietnamese. And, you know, I ask around, I do a lot of research, they help me do research, which is why sometimes I feel really bothered when people still call me out for it. You know, I'm like, they're like, Chris is just, you know, like, you know, making stuff up again. I'm like, no, I've gotten this corroborated so many times. But anyways, we have a program now.
I want to talk about that. I think when you really think about political, historic, linguistic, anything that has to do with, okay, this is the way it really is. This is the rule. This is the way this went down. This is the right way to do it. Anytime we're dealing with these black and white sort of rules and like, oh, this is what happened in history, I think there are so many different perspectives. There could be 20 perspectives on the same thing. There could be 5. But I think that when people comment and people give their opinion, I think that's their truth. I think that that's what they really believe, right? And then so we are left with dealing with the impact of the comment of saying, oh, you got that historical fact wrong, or your guest got it wrong, or you know, go back to Vietnam and live, you know. You get all these, because I mean, in real life, you're debating on these things too, right? You're debating, I'm debating food stuff all the time. I'm debating language stuff all the time. And I feel like there is no one way to kind of get to it. And people would say, no, there's truth in different topics. But now I'm starting to see that there's several truths to one thing. You know, whether you pronounce something one way or meaning some word meaning one way, political history one way. I think there's just so much differing perspectives, no matter what we're talking about in the Vietnamese culture. And, you know, whatever, Italian culture, American culture, it's just so much perspective that I think people have the right to comment and to offer their side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. They do. At first, I was like so bothered that I'm pretty sure this is the reality for me and like the 12 people that I've asked. And then somebody's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, okay, you know, but then it is. That's how that's a good way to put it. That they're living their truth. That's their truth. I used to say like it's their bubble, you know, like everyone's in a bubble and like this is the reality that they know. And then something else outside of that bubble is like so shocking to them that it's just straight wrong. And it's just their truth. It's the reality that they live. And some people react to that new information, you know, more eloquently. And some like feel kind of like a little bit triggered by it, you know? Yeah. And it's like, okay, that's okay too. I don't have to feel bad about that because really it does happen every day. Like you said, we talk about food like that. We talk about language like that, our favorite brands or whatever it is. It happens all the time. Like we don't have to feel weird about it. But I agree with you, Ken, and I think I'm at the same place right now where I'm so comfortable with like just all the gray.
Yeah.
And all the different perspectives and all the possible different realities that could be existing all at the same time that I don't really adhere to any truth so much. You know, I just adhere to like this is the best I know and that's it. You know, I leave like 20, 30, 40, maybe even 50% of like maybe I'm wrong and that's okay.
You and I should start a podcast that just is entitled Celebrating the Vietnamese Gray. And we just talk about all the stuff that mean and undecipherable and we're trying to figure out.
It's still gonna get toxic comments, like
because everything in culture is gray. I mean, that's what makes it beautiful. That's what makes it, you know, fun to talk about. It's all gray.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, just going back to language, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, because you know, as you know, like when we talk about Vietnamese, people put it into categories, right? We have like northern, southern dialect, central dialect, you know, and then the next level of that is understanding that like there's not a central dialect. There's also like Hue, Nghệ An dialect, Quảng Trị dialect, you know, and people are like, oh, he knows what's up, you know, like that is more regional, like that is true. But then you get even more like regional within that, and then you add in there the mixed region, I don't know what you would call it, but basically like mixed region families, you know, northern dad, southern mom, or dad was from the north, lived in the south, but his grandparents are from Hue, you know, like, so you have all this mixture. And so that's why you get these like these bubbles, these truths where people are like, no, that's not how I heard it, you know. It's like, well, did you live with like multi-regional families, more mixed in, and like, you know, and then you add to that another layer, which is our parents raising us in the US who wanted to simplify Vietnamese for us. So they went lax on a lot of rules and things like that. So then we kind of have like another kind of weird mix, you know, where, you know, things might not follow the rules that people think are like conventional Vietnamese. But is it wrong? Like, Yep. I mean, I guess you can argue that it is, but, you know, if enough people speak like that, then is it wrong from a linguistic standpoint?
Interestingly enough, I think the Yiddish, which is the Jewish American way of speaking Hebrew, is born out of the diaspora of the Jewish people leaving, you know, Eastern Europe or during right after the war or during the war, they all left. And, you know, there's a whole, I think for so many cultures that if you're moving in mass and there's a lot of you that leave that country, the words get kind of frozen in ember, right?
Yeah.
And it gets stuck in this pre-75 context. And it's just like a different, now you know, when people in Vietnam listen to it, it's a different language.
Yeah, it's like going down, it's like another branch.
Yeah.
It's like another twig that's growing off of the language tree right now. You know, and they're like, you know, I'm glad you brought up Yiddish because, you know, being like a language nerd too, and then I studied linguistics for my master's, you know, you get presented a lot of these like language trees. And then you notice that, like, you know, that probably happened to all these communities for like as it's been as old as time.
Yeah.
Where people are like, what are they speaking? This is like complete like bullshit. Like, this is not our language. And then it just steadily becomes something else. So how fascinating is that to know that that's happening with Vietnamese, that we are having different communities, different branches, and like, you know, where that's going, if it's going anywhere, I don't know, right? Like, what's the fate of Vietnamese and all these communities? Will we have different branches? I mean, it is definitely evolving within Vietnam, that's for sure. You know, we talk about like overseas and, you know, pre-75 and post-75 Vietnamese. Oh my God, I'm here in Vietnam hearing older Vietnamese here complaining about Gen Z, Gen Alpha slang in Vietnam. That's happening every day, like across all fronts in the language world. You know, people are just angry. They're just like, what is this, you know, Vietnamese slang right now? And it's the same that's happening in English, right?
You know, I think that we as aging humans need to embrace the changing language of our young, like my kids, they'll say the most random genetic things. And I'm like, I want to learn it. I want to hear what they're saying. They call me in sus, you know, and they just use these words. And I think it's so fascinating. And then I start to use it too, because it's like, it's fun. I think it's... evolution of words is so fun, especially when you know, I'm 50 and I'm like, I get to, you know, play with their words. This is amazing and it's fun. It's kind of cringy to them, but you know, it's fun.
I was just gonna say that because I'm like 50-50, because I feel like it's fun to bash on it as the older generation, and it creates camaraderie within our generation.
Yeah.
To bash on the younger generation slang. It's just too hilarious.
I try to not make it awkward. I try to use it like I'm really communicating with them in their language, and to make it not, I don't want that division of father and son or father daughter. I want it to be like, hey, we're using the same words here. It's like the word, you know, like any word in the English lexicon. I just want to be able to like say, hey, we're just talking here. When I'm not trying to like highlight these words, I'm just using it with you and making it like integrating it into, you know, but it's hard to integrate a word like skibbity, you know? It's like,
I was thinking skibbity this whole time we're having this conversation. I will never integrate skibbity. I'm going to say that right now.
Or Riz. That kid got Riz, you know.
Riz I might do. I think I have. But yeah, I kind of like Riz. But I don't know about skibbity.
These are all words that come from, you know, like charisma and Riz. It comes from real words that they just shorthanded, you know.
Yeah. There's that.
But, you know, I think about the term or the title Chris Tran Travels. And I think about how much coverage you've done geographically in Vietnam. I mean, physically have gone to all these places. And the natural evolution of something like that with somebody who teaches language and history is to probably give yourself physically to these places and share it with other people. And I know you've taken that leap, and I'd love to hear about how you got started on that.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Journey.
Yeah, love to talk about it. Very recently, we started a full-on tour company to take people around Vietnam, and it is absolutely me. It is something that I've always dreamed of, and it is a culmination of everything that I love and everything I'm passionate about and all my experiences. And I guess you can even call it training, because, you know, all the history, all the teaching, and yeah, all of that. Plus, I do have to mention that the big inspiration for this tour company is my 6 months studying abroad in Hanoi, this legendary program that I did with a, you know, very amazing professor, Gerard Sasguez, at the time, who was, I believe, working with Berkeley mostly, but he was the director of the program in Hanoi. And it was a small group. I remember coming into the office, the study abroad office at UCLA, and just seeing all these countries, Spain, you know, Japan, and like, you know, and I have to admit, I wanted to go to Japan first, and I didn't make the Japanese language GPA for it. And they're like, how about Vietnam? And I was like, whoa, never considered that. And so the program was like between 11, 15 kids, I think. And it was just amazing. It was kind of strange at first, because when we got there, we weren't allowed to leave. They said you had to stay in Vietnam. You couldn't travel. So we couldn't go to like Angkor Wat or Bali, you know? And I was like, wow, that's weird. Why are they keeping us in the country? But mainly it was because our professor had to take us, the whole group, for 2 weeks through central Vietnam and then 2 weeks through south, the southern part of Vietnam. And he took us to, you know, battle sites, took us to remote villages, took us to like war memorials, you know, visit ethnic minority villages, and gave us reading to do. And it was basically a class, you know, it was basically a mobile class in a van. What a dream, right? I know you would have.
I would come kill for that. Yeah.
Gone nuts, you know? And like, for me, it was emotional, you know, as a Vietnamese American kid, you know, without having any real time to actually study my culture and the history of Vietnam or anything like that, to do this program just blew me away. And I never got over it. You know, it changed my life. And coming back here now and doing content, and this was a similar experience with the language one, where somebody was like, hey, do you do tours? And it kind of put the idea in my mind. And I was like, can I do tours? And I'm like, oh my God, I would love to do that, you know? And I already had basically like something to model it on, which is this extremely profound program that I did. And the program was mostly Vietnamese Americans. There was non-Vietnamese folks on it too. And that was amazing that we got that diversity. But a lot of the Vietnamese American kids, I think, were experiencing what I was experiencing. You know, this is not just a tour. You know, this is us reconnecting with our roots, like, in person, directly. And so I told my friends about it here, you know, like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this, you know, calling it a heritage tour. I want to take folks like me who have this desire, you know, they're seeking this connection, you know, and they want to come to Vietnam and not just join a tour where they're going to eat a bunch of food and take selfies, because that's going to happen anyways. You know, yeah. Like, are we not going to eat good food on this tour? I mean, it's just default, you know, it's just a given. Yeah. No, why don't we add, you know, the history to it? You know, why don't we add the all these special things about our heritage that, you know, you kind of have to go out of the way to find. And I don't think it was that hard, you know, and I managed to curate something that I think is really special. And we have now 10 people on the tour, amazing group.
Ten people on our
first 14-day heritage tour that is happening in a couple months. It's our first one. We're gonna have definitely a lot more because we have already a wait list for it. And the bar is set because on the tour are teachers. We have a psychotherapist on the tour. We have a doctor that works with the Vietnamese community. We don't just have Vietnamese folks on it. There are non-Vietnamese married to Vietnamese spouses, have bicultural children. Absolutely the right kind of person to join this tour, you know. And on the tour, I've, you know, made use of like my network that I've had for 20 years. And also your network, Ken, because, you know, we have, I connected with Nam, who's been on the show, your friend, the archaeologist working out in Gola, and his colleague, Jiling, and going out to the site of Gola, Than Long, and like all these like super significant locations in Vietnamese history, and talking to experts. And then the other side of that is the art side, and connecting with Vietnamese masters who are still doing things like Vietnamese folk art, Dong Ho, in like super important Bac Ninh province, where a lot of Vietnamese art forms come from that are frankly endangered right now. These are endangered art forms.
And when we're talking about endangered, we're talking about like, we're down to like a few people who know the art. It's, yeah. You know, there's this block art person in Hanoi that, you know, the last time I was in Vietnam, one father and his son's like in his 30s, the father's in his like 70s or 80s, I think 80s. And yeah. Those two are the only ones that do that block art, that type, that it's like Dong Ho, the paper stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's all endangered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then and you find things like that throughout the whole country.
Yeah.
You know, we went to Guinyang a few weeks ago, and then Guinyang is famous for martial arts. So Bindin is like where the Taizong rebellion started.
Mm.
The Taizong brothers came from there. And it's renowned for this martial arts form. And yeah, it's also where one of the people I find most interesting from Vietnamese history, Mui Thi Sung, which is this female general of the Taizong. And this was in like the 18th century, where she was like a martial artist and, you know, warrior and military general and first female admiral of Vietnam. Like, what in the world? Because, you know, you hear about female figures like that from when Vietnam was supposedly more matriarchal, you know, thousands of years before that, with the Jung sisters and Bat Kiu and stuff like that, right? But this is like centuries and centuries later. So it makes me wonder about like, how long did this martial tradition go on that you're still producing like female warriors like that in like a pretty Confucian society? Just super intriguing. And there's a massive shrine to her in Guinyang.
Is that the museum? That's going to be on the tour for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And Bindin martial arts is one of those, you know, endangered art forms from Vietnam, because when we were in Guinyang, we had a local guide, from Guinyang, the city. And then he took us out to visit these, you know, martial arts camps. And the whole time he was telling us like, yeah, this is not popular anymore. Kids in the city, they take Taekwondo, they do karate now. No one's really doing Bindin martial arts anymore. It's not popular. And then we go to the countryside and there's like all these kids doing it. And I interviewed a lot of them. And then they're like, you know, my dad did this, and you know, my brothers do this. And you know, I'm interviewing a girl, you know, it's like their little sister.
Yeah.
He's like, I want to do this to protect myself. It's self-defense. And, you know, but it's just like passed down through their family. Right. And it's just in the countryside, in the rural parts of Guinyang. And they took us to like the shrine, where you know, there's the altar to their masters, and at the top of the altar is a portrait of Wang Kyung, right? The emperor from the Taizong Rebellion, you know? So this lineage is going back like hundreds of years, right? And it's profound to me, you know? That is like, just, I can't even describe the feeling of like, you know, connecting to something like that, because as far and distant as I am from it, you know, as an American born Vietnamese, like, you know, growing up in Los Angeles and then making this journey all the way back and then finding this in this remote town in Binh Dinh province, and just like, I feel part of it, you know? Yeah. This is the whole Vietnamese tapestry, the whole culture. And, you know, I'm just like finding this missing piece and adding it to my story, my identity, and then just feeling so proud. And that's why I want other people to experience something like that and just curate all this for them, you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing I think about growing up in America. And if you are not really connected to the Vietnamese communities, what happens is you're kind of like trying to assimilate with other communities, whether it's the Black community or Mexican or white community. You're kind of, when you're forming and you're growing into your own, you kind of try to assume and assimilate into other cultures. And then you go to college and you take a class and you're like, or you bump into a community of Vietnamese people and you're like, there's an awakening. And then from the awakening, you're like, wait a minute, there's this whole thing going on for all these years, and I was completely cut off from the tribe. And that's, I think that's what I've experienced and sounds like what you experienced. And then when you go to Vietnam and you remove all of the sort of the biases that our parents had or the community that you come from, and you just go back and you're like, wait a minute, there's a lot going on here.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I think the tour sounds like it's providing.
Yeah. Yeah. The tour is that bridge. It's that bridge. And it's a bridge that, you know, I work really, really hard to try to do right, because I'm not the expert. You know, I didn't grow up practicing Binh Dinh martial arts. I don't do Dong Ho art. You know, I'm learning about it myself, but I have the network. I have the will to build that bridge and do my best with, like, you know, maybe my teaching experience helps me to connect people to it and present it in the most authentic way possible, and to support the artists and support, you know, the local communities here in Vietnam, because they want that bridge too. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to hide, you know, and like do this in the dark, you know, like they want that bridge. They're so happy to show it. You know, the Dong Ho master who does the block print that we found in Bac Ninh, she is so adorable. And she's like, yeah, you know, bring any group, you know, however big. And, you know, if you want me to talk a lot, I'll talk a lot. If you don't want me to talk a lot, I won't talk a lot. You know, like, she's so accommodating. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
I have a random question. You ever coming back to the U.S. to live? Or are you out there forever?
Ooh, dang. You know, I feel in my heart that I'm here forever.
Hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, you never know. You never know. But I have no desire or plan to head back to the U.S., man. You know, something would have to really shake things up for me and either push me out of Vietnam, you know, or like something has to really pull me,
you know,
back from the U.S.
You mentioned that your brother's there, right?
My little brother is here in Vietnam now.
And there's only two of you? There's two of you, but there's...
It's complicated. Out of my mom's kids, there's three of us. Mm. And we're the closest.
Yeah.
So it's me, my little brother, my little sister, who's 3 years younger than me. My little brother is 17 years younger than me.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's a completely different generation. But
it's beautiful. Yeah. That's because my brother always tried to get me to go too. He's been there for 20 something years now. And this is the one big sadness of my life, is that we grew up together in America. And then in 2004 he picked up and left, and you are fortunate because you got your little brother there now. And you know, if you are a forever Vietnam kid right now, you're going to be there. To have your brother there is such a valuable, you know, because if he stays there for the next 20, 30 years with you, I mean, 20 years goes by real quick. He's been there for 21 years now. And we were there in our early 20s in Vietnam together, like hanging out. And then you blink an eye and we're like, he's 51 this year and I'm 50 this year. And we, you know, we've in the last 21 years, I miss him. And, you know, we're still very close, but, you know, he's got to live away from, you know, he enjoys it thoroughly. He's like you, he'll never come back to the U.S. It's like yeah. whatever noise is going on in the U.S. right now, or whatever noise people have about living in Vietnam, it escapes him entirely because he's living it. He's lived there for over two decades, and he's a professor at RMIT, and he has his own studio and company. But the reality of what he is living is so different from what I'm living, you know. And I wish that, you know, I can't do it anymore because of, I have kids here, but to think that you have that opportunity to stay and really do the work that you really enjoy, I think that's so important.
Yeah, I feel really blessed.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be able to do it. And I reflect on it all the time. And I think that, you know, it's been about 20 years for me, not living consistently in Vietnam, but just like, you know, every Second Dollar Legendary program I told you about. And then just been back and forth. And it wasn't easy convincing my family that, you know, this is what I want to do. You know, I would say maybe it wasn't until maybe a year or two ago that they really started to shift and kind of accept it, you know? So that was kind of the big thing that I felt really guilty about, was like, not only did I choose to live an ocean away, but then I chose to go back to Vietnam, where, you know, they have a lot of feelings about, you know, all the trauma, all the distrust, and, you know, just, I guess, the feeling of like, we sacrificed and we did everything we could to build you this life in the US, and you went to such a good school, and now, of all places, why Vietnam? Why would you go back to Vietnam? You know, I've heard that conversation for so long, you know, even like decades after I had been, you know, kind of going back and forth. And I'm like, are we still on this? You know, like, you see me really committed, you know? And I think finally, you know, after so long, they're like, I don't think he's ever going to change his mind. You know, like, I think he's fully committed, and they see what I'm doing now. And I think that, maybe that's done a lot, you know. They see what I'm doing, they see the community that's kind of gathering around me and the support. And my mom recently, you know, told me she's very proud of what I'm doing. And that just really hit me really deep. And I don't know, maybe they'll join me here. You know, like, it feels like it was kind of a shift, you know. Beautiful. I've been so stubborn about it for so long that they're finally like, okay, so what is this Vietnam thing about? You know, like,
you know, sometimes we have to remove the politics. We have to remove the politics sometimes to really engage with this thought that,
yeah,
when you're in a country and 100 million people speak your language and look like you, there is some profound shift in your psychology and your spirituality and the way you move.
Yeah.
No matter how long you've been gone, and you remove the politics and you remove all that, and you just live and you just eat the food and hear the music and hear the people on the streets. It's just a different reality, you know, than... And it's a beautiful thing. It's for me. I wish that I lived there. You know, I regret, that's one biggest regret in my life, is not moving there when my brother did, you know. But, you know, circumstances, I understand, you know, the way that I had to handle my parent side. We had businesses that I couldn't leave. And, you know, but to this day, I'm like, Wow. What a life my brother and you now live, you know. And I you know, it's hard to separate the politics, but sometimes we just have to suspend it just so we can just enjoy the beauty of what Vietnamese culture and Vietnamese life is like.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was a government teacher. I taught AP government in high school for like 7 years. And, you know, we were taught to teach, you know, we taught kids that like politics is everything. It's in everything. And it is, you know, if you look for it, it is in
America. In America, it is. You know? In Vietnam, there's nobody talking about politics on the street.
Oh, I mean, it's everything is still political. You could argue that like everything is political, but it doesn't mean you have to live it as like at the forefront of your life and your reality all the time. And I don't think you should. For your health, for your mental health, I don't think you should, because there's so much beauty beyond it. If you just like let it, put it to the side, and what's left is like, you know, your Vietnamese identity, your culture, your community. There's all these people that, you know, are here in Vietnam that I think day to day, like you said, like they don't live it. They're not out here screaming politics or you know, letting it color the way they see each other and even us, you know. Like I think I've talked to you about this before. Like growing up in the US, I feel like we are hyper political, you know, and the Vietnamese community is hyper political.
Yeah.
You know, we have like double layer of being super political, like all the time with everything, you know? And then coming here, it's like you said, like people aren't that political. And I guess you could argue that they can't really talk about it here, but I don't know which came first. You know, like is it just not a big part of everyday Vietnamese life here? Or like, you know, is it the government? I don't know. Maybe it feeds into each other. I don't know. But the truth is that people don't really get like that in everyday life here.
Yeah.
You see it online. you see it on Facebook.
You don't see it on the street.
But I don't see it on the street. And like no one's giving me a hard time. And it just doesn't happen. People don't care about that stuff here. People are laughing. People are joking. They're eating. They're going out. They're spending time together.
Yeah.
You know, like
a lot of time together.
And they're happy.
Happy. Yeah. It's hard to explain. It's hard to really convey that. But one thing we can convey is I am teaming up with you to create affiliate links so that anybody who is interested in the conversation that we just had can find Chris's language courses and the heritage tour that he's just talked about. So Chris, can you kind of say it where we can find this information?
Yeah, so for the Vietnamese courses, we have self-paced courses and we have these awesome live classes going on, and our star product is Heritage Vietnamese Classes, which we cater to overseas Vietnamese folks who have grown up surrounded by Vietnamese, but just never formally learned it in school. So, you know, we talk about things that are really relevant to Vietnamese people growing up. We teach it in Vietnamese, but then we get people the structures, the grammar, and get you speaking more eloquently in Vietnamese, which is something we all want to do growing up, you know, in a Vietnamese household. Survival Vietnamese is the name of the company. So you can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Survival Vietnamese. And then for our tour company, it's called Third Culture Vietnam. You can find us on thirdculturevietnam.com. You can also find us on all the social platforms. And we have Saigon tours that are running all year round. But our heart and soul right now is our heritage tour, which is 14 days from northern Vietnam to southern Vietnam. We have one set for July 1st. And there's still seats open for that. And we also have a wait list so that you can let us know which dates work for you, and we'll announce future ones that me and a small team will lead. So there are Vietnamese overseas running it, as well as local Vietnamese. So I think it's a very special team that we have. But yeah, Survival Vietnamese for the language courses, and then Third Culture Vietnam for our tour company. Thank you so much, Ken. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it was really good. It's always fun to talk. And hopefully we can catch up after your first heritage tour in a few months. Yeah, I'd love to hear how it goes. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.